this idea of arguing against incarceration for youth, just across the board, arguing against incarceration and for rehabilitation. We have, on average, about 1 million arrests per year. About 1/4 of those cases go through the adult court system. On any given day, there are about 50,000 kids sitting in juvenile detention, and there are another 10,000 kids sitting in an adult correctional facility, mostly a jail, right, where they're awaiting their hearings. And that's just crazy. That's a huge amount of kids.
That's Kara Drinan, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Kara Drinan on the justice system's war on kids. The juvenile justice system is off the rails. It is in urgent need of reform. The United States incarcerates roughly 2 million children every year, even though 95% of them have not been convicted of a violent crime. Too many of them are held in adult jails. The systemic problems range from racism to brutality and extreme sentencing. Thousands of kids, many of them suffering from trauma, come of age behind bars. 2/3 of them have mental health issues. They are subject to physical and sexual assault. They are up to 36 times more likely to commit suicide after being housed in an adult jail or prison than children incarcerated in juvenile facilities. The Equal Justice Initiative says confinement of children in adult facilities is indefensible, cruel, and unusual punishment and should be banned. Our guest today is Kara Drinan. She's professor of law at Catholic University and is a recognized expert on juvenile sentencing and criminal justice reform. She's the author of The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. She spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. And now, Kara Drinan.
I want to begin by telling you a little bit about Terrence Graham. So in 2003, when Terrence was 16, he and three teens attempted to rob a barbecue restaurant in Jacksonville, Florida. They entered through a back door at closing time. They fled when the angry manager, confronted them. And one of Terrence's co-defendants had a metal bar that night, and he did strike the manager, sending him to the emergency room for stitches. And I don't mean to minimize that, but just to say that no one was seriously injured in this event. And Terrence himself did not use or even wield a weapon during any of this. And nonetheless, Terrence was sentenced to life without parole for his involvement in that attempted armed robbery. And so you hear that and you think, like, oh my gosh, you know, how does that happen? And maybe one of the saddest parts of his case is not just the sentencing structure that made that possible, but the fact that the Florida judge who imposed that sentence, before he imposed it, he kind of wondered aloud why Terrence would throw his life away. When he'd been given, you know, what the judge said was quite a family structure. In fact, he said, I don't understand why you'd be given such an opportunity to do something with your life and why you'd throw it away. And in fact, nothing could have been farther from the truth, right? So what I came to learn in my research and in getting to know Terrence is that he grew up in abject poverty. He had two crack-addicted parents. His mother obtained her crack by allowing others to get high in the home. It's called paying the house lady. So there were often adults in the home getting high, and they didn't want to hear the sounds of young children. So Terrence and his brothers, from the time they were very young, were often sent out into the streets of Jacksonville just to create quiet space in the home. Terrence endured physical, emotional, and verbal abuse that was documented by social services from the time he was a toddler. He was diagnosed with ADHD in his youth, but he was never medicated. His mother would not allow it. When I met Terrence in 2012, I asked him about his schooling experience because I was curious in particular about the ADHD and his time in school, and his answer was, it's really hard to be in school when you're hungry. So by the time he was in the 10th grade, I mean the 10th grade, he was arrested that year for that armed robbery that I mentioned. By that time, he'd attended 9 schools because his family was moving so often from one subsidized housing unit to another. And so life was violent and chaotic for Terrence his entire childhood, despite what that judge said at his sentencing in 2005. And sadly, Terrence is not alone. In my opinion, the United States has waged a war on kids, and like most wars, this particular war has had the biggest impact on poor, minority, and otherwise vulnerable youth like Terrence. So this is what the war on kids looks like. Today in the United States, prosecutors routinely transfer kids out of juvenile court into the adult court system, often without judicial oversight. Youth in adult court are subject to mandatory minimums that were drafted with adults in mind. Youth can be housed in adult correctional facilities, despite the fact that we know youth in those facilities are at the highest risk for physical and sexual assault. Youth are subject to conditions of confinement that I think most of us would think of as only appropriate for adult offenders, and really even the most violent among those adult offenders. So things like mechanical restraints, even solitary confinement. Until 2005, the United States was the only developed nation in the world that executed people for juvenile crimes. And today, we are the only developed nation in the world that sentences our children to die in prison. How did this happen, right? That's the question. How is it possible that Terrence and thousands of other individuals across the country, thousands, were sentenced to die in prison before they were old enough to get a tattoo, to vote, certainly to buy a beer? How is it that that cruel indifference that Terrence experienced as a child, how's that woven into our laws and policies? And maybe most importantly, how do we correct course, right? So those are the central questions of the war on kids. Okay, so the first question, how did this happen? So the war on kids, like mass incarceration itself, is a relatively recent phenomenon. The United States invented the juvenile court at the end of the 19th century in Illinois, and it wasn't perfect by any stretch. It was not perfect, but it was prompted by this ethic of paternalism, right, and this shared recognition that children who break the law or who are accused of breaking the law, they're typically in need of social services, right, rather than punishment, and certainly not the kind of punishment that we would mete out for adults. So that was the basic concept behind the juvenile court model that was invented in 1899. And over the course of the 20th century, every other state in this country adopted the idea of a juvenile court, a separate judicial system for kids, as did every developed nation around the globe. But the interesting thing is that while we were exporting that idea to other states and to other countries, we also were abandoning it domestically. And in order to understand how that happened and how it happened in such a short period of time, relatively speaking, I think it helps to think of the war on kids as a subplot to the story of mass incarceration. And I don't know how much folks know about that story, but it's certainly in the headlines a lot. Today in the United States, there are more than 2 million adults and children behind bars. In 1970, there were fewer than 200,000. So that's pretty dramatic, right? That means in the last 4 decades, we've seen the population balloon 10 times. And that's just my lifetime. So this is a new phenomenon, the mass incarceration phenomenon. And as I'm sure you know just from reading headlines again, mass incarceration has not affected Americans equally. Right? 4 out of 5 criminal defendants are poor. And while those criminal defendants are entitled to a lawyer, a zealous lawyer, actually, most public defenders are overworked and underpaid. And as a result, those individuals, poor defendants, don't receive on a regular basis, do not receive the kind of zealous representation to which they're entitled under the Sixth Amendment. So that's a poverty issue. There's also a race issue with our system. As Michelle Alexander and the New Jim Crow and others have documented, mass incarceration has taken a tremendous toll on minority communities. Minorities in America today are exponentially more likely to be under correctional control. Black and Latino communities in this country comprise less than one-third of the general population, more than two-thirds of the correctional population. So there's just a huge overrepresentation in the system. You may have seen, again, this came up during the presidential debates, that 1 in 3 black males born today, based on current incarceration rates, 1 in 3 black males born today can expect to spend some time in prison. I mean, that's just shocking, right? That's a damning statistic. So with the rise of crime in the 1970s, there was, in fact, a steady increase in crime in this country between the 1970s and the 1990s, peaking in the mid-1990s. And what happened is that politicians across the political spectrum adopted tough-on-crime policies, right, felt this political need to be tough on crime. In some ways, on the left, even more so, I think, more pressure. So, again, across the political spectrum, across the nation, lawmakers enacted more criminal laws, right, put more crimes on the books, and also attached stiffer sentences for those crimes. So as we sent more people to prison for longer periods of time, our prison population ballooned. And juveniles suffered from that trend, too. There were really two pieces of these tough-on-crime policies that were particularly detrimental to kids. And those were transfer laws and the introduction of what are called mandatory minimums. So let me say a little bit about each of those. So transfer laws. For most of the 20th century, a child who was accused of a crime was dealt with in juvenile court, that juvenile court model I mentioned that was founded in Illinois. In rare cases, if a prosecutor thought that the child had been accused of a crime that just exceeded the punitive limits of the juvenile court, in rare cases, the prosecutor could seek to have that case moved to adult court. But the prosecutor had to ask a judge, right, had to convince a judge that this case was one that really couldn't be handled in juvenile court. And so that process was rare and it was difficult. As part of tough-on-crime politics, though, of the 1980s and 1990s, lawmakers passed what are called transfer laws that made it increasingly easy and increasingly common for kids to be transferred out of juvenile court into adult court. So every jurisdiction in the country today has at least one provision. Many have several provisions that allow a child, just through legislative fiat, that allow a child, it's just a fiction, right, to be prosecuted as an adult. In some jurisdictions, in fact, in 21 jurisdictions, there is no minimum age that a child must be in order to be transferred to adult court. And in many jurisdictions, there are what are called once an adult, always an adult provisions, which means if a 15-year-old is charged as an adult in one crime, going forward, he or she will always be charged as an adult. So we just saw in the late 20th century this radical change in the ease with which cases could be charged against kids in adult court. And around the exact same time, that 1980s, 1990s period, states were also moving from what were called indeterminate sentencing schemes to determinate sentencing schemes. We hear about that more in the context of mandatory minimums. So before the 1980s, a judge would usually have had the opportunity to look at a case, to look at both the nature of the offense, the nature of the offender, although I hate that term, it's a placeholder, and exercise some discretion about what the appropriate sentence would be. But the move away from that toward determinate sentencing schemes meant that the legislature set in advance what sentence attached to a given crime. So we started sentencing based on the offense, not the offender. And so this was the perfect storm for kids, right? It was the perfect storm for kids. It's not even clear, in my research, it's obvious to me that it's not even clear that lawmakers were thinking about the interaction of these two things. But what happened is that you had kids ending up in adult court, right, with increasing frequency and ease. And once they got there, they were subject to these mandatory minimums that were drafted with adults in mind. I'll give you an example of what that looks like on the less extreme end of the spectrum. There are certainly life without parole cases that were mandatory, and those are the extreme end of the spectrum, but Andre Lyle. His case came out of Iowa. And at 17, Andre had a fight with a high school classmate over a $5 bag of marijuana. Andre, in his mind, he had paid for this bag of marijuana, he was entitled to it, and he had a fist fight in the schoolyard. And he punched his classmate, and he grabbed that $5 bag of marijuana, and he bolted. Well, he was charged with second-degree robbery. He was transferred to adult court, and he was convicted as an adult of second-degree robbery. And the judge, in his case, had no choice but to impose the mandatory minimum that the legislature had set. And that mandatory minimum was 10 years prison time, with 7 years required before parole eligibility. So there's no way, I mean, I'm an optimist by nature, there is no way that the legislators who enacted that statute were thinking about a schoolyard fight over a $5 bag of marijuana when they put a 10-year mandatory minimum on that. And yet, that's just an example of how that worked. And had he been in juvenile court, that never would have happened. Or at least the judge would have had some choice. So that's sort of a quick, really quick, primer on how we got here, right? How did we simultaneously invent the juvenile court and then within 100 years abandon its very premise? I want to turn now and talk a little bit about Supreme Court decisions in this area. For the latter half of the 20th century, the Supreme Court didn't do a lot on kids, right? It didn't look at a lot of juvenile sentencing issues or juvenile procedural rights after the mid-1960s. For those of us interested in this, the last decade or so has been really an interesting time. And I talk about this hopefully in a way that is accessible to non-lawyers. I want this to be accessible to non-lawyers because we need non-lawyers to understand what's going on and to feel invested in changing this. So I'll try to do that tonight too and just talk about three cases that are really crucial. So beginning in 2005, in a series of cases that are referred to as the Miller Trilogy, the Supreme Court began to rein in the extent to which states could subject kids to the most severe sanctions at law. And those sanctions are the death penalty and life without parole. So, 2005, case called Roper versus Simmons, the court looked at the question of whether or not Christopher Simmons could be executed for a homicide he'd committed as a teenager. There was no claim of actual innocence. There was no argument regarding incompetence. It was just his age, right? His argument was, I'm a kid. And it was a hard case because the facts of it were pretty brutal. And nonetheless, the Supreme Court held that the Eighth Amendment bars the death penalty for juveniles, right, categorically, even those who commit homicide. And the court held that juveniles are less culpable and they're more amenable to rehabilitation. And this decision, the Roper versus Simmons decision, is really crucial today, even though it's 12 years old now, because it set the stage for these later decisions in the sense that the court relied heavily on neuroscience in the Roper decision. So that science tells us what every parent knows, certainly what I know from mothering a 9 and a 12-year-old boy. So the frontal lobe of our brain is not fully developed until well into our 20s. And that is the part of our brain that governs things like judgment and long-term decision-making and risk assessment and planning. And so because that part of the brain is underdeveloped until well into the 20s, guess what? Kids are impulsive. They don't think about long-term consequences. They're not good at risk assessment. They're more subject to peer pressure than their adult counterparts are. So the linchpin of that Roper Court's decision was kids are different. They're different biologically. They're not just small adults. They are actually different. And we need to treat them differently in the eyes of the law. So that was 2005. Court abolishes death penalty for kids. It's a little scary that it took us until 2005 to do that, but it did. And so 5 years later, in Graham versus Florida, the court heard Terrence Graham's challenge to that life without parole sentence that I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks. And Terrence had a great attorney, a guy named Brian Gowdy, who argued his case before the Supreme Court. And his claim was, kids like Terrence have what we think of as twice diminished culpability, right? Number one, he's a kid, or he was at the time of the crime. And number two, this is not a homicide crime. And so typically, the death penalty and life without parole, because they are the two most severe sanctions we have on the books, those are things that we think of as being reserved for homicide offenses typically. Or at least there was a point in time when we did. So Terrence's argument before the Supreme Court was, given that I'm a juvenile, given that I committed a non-homicide offense, this life without parole sentence, which is, by the way, analogous to a death penalty for a kid, right? If you're serving a life without parole sentence, you're serving a far greater proportion of your life if you enter that sentence as a teen. And the court agreed. And it's almost as if the court was really reaching to find a way to hold that this was cruel and unusual. And so for people like me who were really invested in following this case, this was a huge decision. Many people at the time said, this is not a huge decision, and here's why. So I mentioned that Terrence was serving life without parole for a non-homicide offense. If you had to guess, how many people in the country would you think are serving that sentence, a similar sentence, people like Terrence? Well, it was about 130. That's not a lot. When you have 2 million people behind bars, that's not a lot of people. So at first, there were many, even many academics, who thought this is just a Florida case because most of those 130 individuals were in Florida. I mean, and just as an aside, Florida is just a disaster on the criminal justice front, right? I mean, it's like an outlier among outliers. And so at the time of Graham versus Florida, people thought, okay, this is just a weird case that's mostly about Florida, about 130 kids. They're going to get a parole hearing, they're going to get denied, and they're going to be sent back to spend their life in prison. Not only did that not happen, but more importantly, there was a much larger pool of inmates, about 2,500 inmates nationwide, serving life without parole for a homicide offense that they committed as kids. And so the Graham decision really begged this question, okay, well, what about that bigger pool of individuals, right? What about them? Because they also had underdeveloped brains. They also had a diminished culpability. And so only 2 years later, in Miller versus Alabama, the court took up that question of life without parole and whether it was constitutional, even for individuals who commit homicide offenses. That was Evan Miller's case. At 14 years old, Evan Miller killed a neighbor. In fact, he killed his mother's drug dealer, with whom Evan had been drinking and smoking marijuana on the night of the homicide. By the age of 14, Evan had been in and out of foster care. His mother was an alcoholic, a drug addict. His stepfather abused him. So he had a pretty horrific history, none of which came to light during his sentencing. Right? He was charged as an adult at 14. And once he was convicted of murder in Alabama, again, back to mandatory minimums, there was no other sentence available under the law other than life without parole. So in Miller, the court held that states cannot impose mandatory life without parole on juveniles. Juvenile justice advocates were hoping and praying that the court would just flat out ban juvenile life without parole. It did not. But it did say that before a judge or a state, some sentencing body, could impose life without parole on a juvenile, that it needed to go through a really searching analysis of that child's social history, their academic history, their familial and health history. Things like, for example, the fact that this kid had been in and out of foster care, that he was abusing substances, that he had been physically abused, right? That the courts needed to look at those social context factors. And the court also signaled in Miller, it addressed the fact that it hadn't banned the sentence outright, but it said, we think, given what we know about the juvenile brain, that appropriate cases for juvenile life without parole will be rare. In fact, the court said they would be exceedingly rare. So that was a huge move forward, too. And immediately after that decision, the day after that decision, organizations like the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth tried to begin to follow the tentacles of who are these 2,500 individuals, right? Because they only had a certain amount of time to try to get relief from that decision. And then we had this sort of collateral battle going on. And I won't get too bogged down in it, but there was this question, well, who gets to benefit from the Miller rule And in the constitutional law arena, we call that a retroactivity issue. So in other words, the question was, does that Miller rule apply to those 2,500 people who were already sentenced? Or does it only apply going forward? Right? Does it only mean that from here on out, states can't do what they did to Evan Miller? And the states across the country dealing with those 2,500 were split on that issue. And in 2016, the Supreme Court, in a case called Montgomery versus Louisiana, said yes, it is a decision that applies retroactively. And so across the country today, people like Henry Montgomery from Montgomery versus Louisiana and Evan Miller are in the process of getting resentencing hearings and in some cases parole hearings. Together, these cases, this Miller trilogy, they stand for the proposition that kids are different, that they're different in the eyes of the law, and that state sentencing practices must reflect that fact. The last thing I want to talk about is the question of where we go from here, right? What do we do about all of this? How do we leverage what the Supreme Court has done? And how do we put an end to some of these practices just as citizens, never mind as lawyers? But let me just say a few things. And the first thing that we need to do in order to pursue juvenile justice reform is aggressively pursue criminal justice reform nationally. Not forget about kids, just the criminal justice reform issues. And the reason I say that I didn't think I needed to say that a year ago is because the moment, right, the summer of 2016 was just a totally different time, right? And it's just been remarkable to me that in the early 21st century, politicians across the political spectrum have really come to recognize that our criminal justice system is broken, right? You see completely unlikely allies, right? You see the Charles Koch Foundation partnering with, the ACLU. These are unlikely bedfellows, but they've come together because there's this recognition, as I said at the outset, that with 2 million adults and children behind bars, the United States leads the world in its rate of incarceration, right? We have 5% of the world's population on this United States, right? We have 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's prisoners. And that's not because we are more criminally inclined than other people. That's just a function of our laws and our policies that we've chosen to impose. And the status quo, forget, as I said, this is not, I'm not even talking about the juveniles in the system. That system itself, the machinery of mass incarceration, has a hugely detrimental effect on kids, even kids who aren't yet in the system as criminal defendants. Right, so for example, almost 3 million kids in this country today have an incarcerated parent, 1 in 28 kids. And we know that that's related to future contact with the criminal justice system, right? That does correlate. We spend $80 billion a year on corrections, and that's money that we're spending to warehouse people, not spending on things like education and social services that we know keep people out of the system. Okay? Race matters, as I said, race matters at literally every juncture in the system. And so the system is broken. It's broken entirely. And so the first thing that we need to do in order to pursue a way to end the war on kids is to continue to pursue national criminal justice reform. That's a necessary, it's not a sufficient condition, but it's a necessary condition to doing that.
You're listening to Kara Drynan on the justice system's war on kids.
The second thing we need to do, and this is, I guess, more for the legal community, is really make sure that those Supreme Court cases that I talked about are implemented in a meaningful way. And so, you know, the way the Supreme Court works is they handle, you know, 100-some-odd cases per year. They're confined to looking at each case or controversy. And once they've announced a ruling, it takes years, if not decades, for those decisions to trickle down and to be implemented. And whether or not they'll be implemented in a meaningful way, in a way that's consistent with what the court envisioned, is a totally separate question. Right? Think about how Brown versus Board of Education was implemented. It was not implemented peacefully. It was not implemented because the lower courts and state legislatures said, oh, separate is not equal. Right? It did not happen that way. And so when it comes to these decisions, as you can imagine, there's much to be excited about. right? But it's not all encouraging. So I'll start with the encouraging stuff. In 2011, the year before the court heard Evan Miller's challenge to his juvenile life without parole sentence, there were only 5 states in the country that banned juvenile life without parole, that recognized the unfairness of that sentence. And as of this year, 19 states plus the District of Columbia have banned juvenile life without parole. So that's pretty good, right? That's pretty good progress. Parole reviews are underway in states that had significant juvenile life without parole, JLWAP is the term we use for those populations. Massachusetts and California, significant JLWAP populations, parole proceedings are underway for some of those individuals. So that's encouraging. Now to the less encouraging news. The Graham decision, let's start with Graham. So Graham versus Florida. The court says juveniles cannot be sentenced to life without parole if they're convicted of non-homicide offenses. So Terrence's case, for example, he was sent back to the Florida courts, and those courts were to then resentence him to a more appropriate sentence. So you might think, he can't get life without parole for that attempted armed robbery. What is an appropriate sentence? He received a 25-year sentence. So if he survives, he'll be 39, almost 39, when he's released from prison for that attempted armed robbery of that barbecue restaurant at 16. That, in my opinion, is a travesty, but sadly, he's one of the lucky individuals. You know, I mentioned there were about 130-some-odd individuals in his sort of similarly situated pool. Some of the individuals whose cases were revisited by lower courts received 45 years, 65 years, how about 89 years? A federal court recently upheld an 89-year sentence and said it's not the same thing as life without parole for a non-homicide offense because they were consecutive sentences that added up to 89 years, as opposed to a flat life without parole sentence. So there will be, there is now, and there will be for quite some time, litigation around what is a de facto life sentence, right? And how far can a court push it in terms of imposing a sentence that is, in my opinion, certainly the equivalent of life. So there's another question of implementation that comes from Graham. The Graham court said someone like Terrence may in fact end up needing to serve his entire life in prison, but the state cannot make that decision on the day it sentences that person. Right, they need to do some kind of periodic assessment. And actually, what the court said is they need to provide a meaningful opportunity to obtain release. And again, the court doesn't say what that means. It says you need to give them a meaningful opportunity to obtain release. And it's up to the states to determine what that means. So, for example, is geriatric release a meaningful opportunity for a juvenile to obtain release? I would say no. I would say that's an end run around what the court asked the states to do. One state has tried to argue that. How about a parole process that is all but defunct, right? Part of the tough on crime policies of the 80s were abolition of parole, right? They included abolition of parole in many jurisdictions. And if not legal abolition of it, de facto, right? It's largely gone, and or when the parole board meets, no one gets paroled. Right? And there's no explanation of why, there's no basis upon which to appeal, there's no right of appeal, there's no transparency. So again, is that a meaningful opportunity to obtain release? I would argue no. These are open questions, and literally, the answers to these questions will determine whether people will die in prison for adolescent mistakes like Terrence's. So those are some questions of implementation that really demand attention from the legal community. Similarly, the Miller court, Evan Miller's case, even though the court said that it wasn't outright banning juvenile life without parole, it did say, as I mentioned, that appropriate circumstances for that sentence should be exceedingly rare, and that is not proving to be the case. So Michigan, for example, Michigan is one of the states that houses a high population of juvenile lifers, and in that jurisdiction, because those 300-some-odd individuals in that state are entitled to a new sentencing hearing, the prosecutor has to decide what he or she's going to ask for, right? Well, again, because the court said that that JLWAP should be an exceedingly rare sentence, one would think that it wouldn't be all or even that many of those 300 cases. But the prosecutors in Michigan are seeking juvenile life without parole all over again for more than half of the inmates in the state. So we're not seeing robust implementation of these cases. And then I should mention that one of the things that really shocked me in my research was just to understand the scale and the scope of this problem. So the implementation of Graham and Miller that I've talked about, for example, does not even begin to touch cases that aren't within those holdings. So in other words, I'll give you a couple examples. I get letters from inmates across the country all the time who say, here's my situation. I entered into a plea agreement at 16. Part of the plea agreement was waiving my right to an appeal, and I agreed to a 65-year term sentence. Can I get some relief under these? Because if I serve 65 years, I'm definitely going to die in prison. And it seems like what the court was getting at is that I shouldn't die in prison for something I did at 16 without ever getting a second look. And I agree with that person who's writing me that letter, but his case does not fall within the Graham and Miller decisions. It may someday, there may be a court that says, well, the spirit of what the Supreme Court meant in those cases suggests that individual should get a second look. But as a matter of rigid interpretation, it doesn't. And that's really heartbreaking, right? Because, as I said, in my opinion, those are cases where we sentenced a child to die in prison. And under the Supreme Court's directives, those individuals are entitled to a review of those sentences, and they're not always getting them. So ending the war on kids requires vigilance from the legal community, certainly, in terms of really pushing hard for the implementation of these cases. And then, of course, there's this whole other space of where I'd like to see the case law go. I think that those cases tell us that kids belong in juvenile court and that mandatory transfer laws should also be unconstitutional under those decisions. And there is some movement to argue for that. I've heard from lawyers saying, hey, you wrote a law review article about that. Can we translate that into a legal challenge? So hopefully that's on the horizon. Similarly, I think mandatory minimums are problematic enough for adults, but they have no place when sentencing children. They're just completely inappropriate in my mind. And I think they're also unconstitutional after these recent Supreme Court decisions. Those are two things I think we need to do in terms of pursuing a war for kids, is just keep at it on the criminal justice reform front, keep at it as lawyers in the legal community trying to really make sure these cases have meaning as they trickle down to the states. And the last thing I'll talk about tonight is this idea of arguing against incarceration for youth, just across the board, arguing against incarceration and for rehabilitation. And so, you know, one of the things that's really sobering is that youth incarceration rates are down today than they were at their peak in the mid-1990s, but we still have too many kids in the system. We have, on average, about 1 million arrests per year. About 1/4 of those cases go through the adult court system. On any given day, there are about 50,000 kids sitting in juvenile detention, and there are another 10,000 kids sitting in an adult correctional facility, mostly a jail, right, where they're awaiting their hearings. And that's just crazy. That's a huge amount of kids. And we don't reserve it for serious offenses. Sometimes people hear that and think, well, that must be a lot of law-breaking kids. Yes, there are kids who commit serious crimes. But only about 25% of kids in juvenile detention are being held on the basis of serious offenses. And by serious, I mean things like aggravated assault, sexual assault, homicide, and armed robbery. Those are serious offenses. But only about 1/4 of the kids in detention are even charged with those, which means we've got a ton of kids in the system who are there because they're doing age-appropriate things, right? They're acting out in the hallways in high school, or they've broken a curfew, or they were drinking alcohol in public, right? Technically, those are crimes. They're status offenses because of the status of being a juvenile. You obviously can't be drinking. You can't be out past curfew. But the problem, in addition to just the soul-crushing aspect of incarceration, the problem is that we know youth incarceration has what's called a criminogenic effect, which is just a very fancy way of saying that it makes someone a better criminal. Right? If you put a child who has a history of trauma, and most kids in the system have a history of trauma, 2/3 have a mental health diagnosis, if you put that child in a correctional facility, it's easy to see why they're going to become better criminals, if you will. Right? Youth incarceration is a survival experience, whether it's in youth detention or in an adult prison. It is truly a survival experience. Most young people in prison who write to me universally wake up each day hoping to survive that day, hoping to survive it, meaning fending off physical and sexual assault. And the choice, if you're trying to fend off assault, is either to succumb to that, right, which is obviously traumatic, or to be aggressive. In prison, there are so many rules, and individuals can get tickets, disciplinary write-ups, whatever the facility calls them, for any number of things, not just for fighting or fending off a fight, but for things like, you know, walking too close to a fence, or not keeping your cell neat enough, or being late for a visitor, right? You're walking a gauntlet all the time. And the skills that a person needs to acquire in order to survive that incarceration experience are exactly the opposite of what they need to be productive members of society. Right? And at the same time, we know that 80% of youth who are charged as adults will be back in society before their 21st birthday. Right? So even if readers, listeners, citizens, even if people don't empathize with the plight of kids who enter the system, and I do, I think the system is rigged, and that if it, and then it's rigged along class and racial lines. But even if you don't empathize with that, we all have a collective interest. Just because we know these kids are coming back into society, we have a collective interest in ensuring that we keep kids out of facilities to the extent that we can. And that when they really need to be there, that we ensure that that form of detention improves that child rather than further damaging them. So I will end there. Thank you so much for your attention.
You mentioned that many of the prosecutors who are moving children into the adult system have some options as to whether they're doing that. What is the pressure to move them into the adult system, and do they feel like the results are appropriate? I mean, are there people saying, yeah, we think life without parole is appropriate for this guy?
Sometimes prosecutors have discretion. There are three ways a child can end up in adult court. So three different transfer mechanisms. The first is that old-fashioned way, which where the prosecutor has to go to the judge and say, here's a kid who I think belongs in adult court. And that's to your question of like, do they really think that's a good thing? And I'll come back to that. The second is what's called direct file, where the law says nothing about whether the kid needs to be in juvie or adult court, and the prosecutor can just do that without discussing it with the judge. That's the most problematic. And the other are what are called statutory exclusion laws, laws that say if you're above a certain age or charged with a certain offense, it's just the nature of the offense, then the prosecutor doesn't have to make a choice. It's just that case is going to be dealt with in adult court. But when we're talking about things that involve the discretion of the prosecutor, at the risk of sounding like a deeply cynical person who's anti-prosecutor, and I'm not, right? I tell my students all the time, I encourage them to be prosecutors because we need good prosecutors. But I think that one of the dangers is that prosecutors are judged by success, and success involves things like conviction rates and length of sentence. And add to that the fact that in some jurisdictions, they elect their prosecutors. And, you know, you look at the 39 jurisdictions that elect their judges, and those judges are campaigning on the severity of sentences, right, that they've been able to hand down. So I do think that there's a culture on the prosecution side that can lead to this sense of the more people I can convict and the stiffer the sentences I can get, the better I'm doing. And that's just a cultural danger in prosecution's offices.
What has been the role of law schools in mm-hmm. creating perhaps an environment that encourages this level of prosecution against juveniles?
We're certainly in a phase in legal education where, again, because of the American Bar Association, there's a push toward focusing on a renewed focus on things like representing the indigent on a pro bono basis and that sort of thing. But I don't know that law schools are making that worse. I'd like to think we're not. I'd be lying if I didn't say that I think my colleagues, for example, who were prosecutors before they came to academia, they probably teach criminal procedure very differently than I do, right? And I would imagine that that affects people's sense of what's right and appropriate for prosecutors.
I wanted to get your opinion on two different issues,
okay.
two things that came to mind during your talk. One is, it seems to me that as long as we have a capitalist system in which people are making money off of others being in prison, that there's, as long as there's a financial incentive for people to be there, the prison population is going to keep growing. So, you know, while we can look at the case studies and at the micro level and say, this person shouldn't be in jail for this reason, they have XYZ factors, class, race, etc., I'm more curious in terms of, like, the big picture, like what,
yeah.
What you think is actually going on in terms of intent, which then brings me, so that's the one issue, is the private prisons and,
yeah.
and what you see is that. The second question is related, which is, I don't know if people here have seen the movie 13th, on the third, yeah, same director as Selma. That movie really opened up a lot of people's eyes, definitely opened up my eyes. And one of the things that was quoted in there was Nixon's advisor saying that the reason that they started the war on drugs was so they could go after the black rights, civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
People on the left, progressives. And that then directly feeds into, again, not only are we locking people up and targeting activists in certain aspects, but mm-hmm. then making money off the fact that they're now in prison working for us. So can you comment on those two things, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. So to the first point, so the private prison thing, I think, unfortunately, I wish it were just a question of we need to get rid of private prisons, because that would be a much simpler fix. Private prisons actually comprise a very small percentage of correctional facilities that we have in this country. There's no doubt that they're problematic for the reasons that you articulated. I think the bigger concern that we do need to be going after, just given the proportion of prisons that are actually private, the issue that I think is driving the profit concerns you mentioned are unions representing correctional officers. So, you know, prisons are built, not coincidentally, in faraway places so that we can pretend that people who commit a crime or some criminals are elsewhere, not human beings like the rest of us. And so it's out of sight, out of mind. But oftentimes, you know, you go to visit, well, at least I do in my research, a prison, and you got to drive like 4 hours from a major metropolis to get there. And so that's the town's employment. Right, and we see that across the country, that correctional officers are very resistant. The unions are very resistant to job loss, right, or to anything that would reduce the need for that. So that, I think, is a bigger issue and needs more direct confrontation in the political process than even the private prison issue. To your second point, there is no doubt that that the war on crime, the war on drugs, the war on kids, it's been racially coded from the beginning. If you look, you mentioned the Nixon era issue. Same was true, I would say, also with the war on drugs in the Reagan era. I mean, the war on drugs, you know, we started ramping up the war on drugs and rolling out federal money to beef up state-level law enforcement long before the crack epidemic, right? It was not we had a crack epidemic and then we responded with beefed up law enforcement. It was actually predated that. And so I think, and you know, you think about the rhetoric and the images of what the war on drugs entailed and the image that the administration was putting forth of like welfare queens and just, you know, this idea. I mean, it was so racially coded, you almost can't believe that they got away with saying it. So I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. And that's why I mentioned Michelle Alexander's work, because, you know, her argument, her claim in her book, The New Jim Crow, is that the correctional system today is what Jim Crow laws once were, right? First we had slavery, and then we had Jim Crow laws, and now we have the correctional system, and that it's basically accomplishing the same end as both of those prior institutions, slavery and Jim Crow.
You mentioned Reagan and Nixon. Did incarceration rates go down under the Obama administration, or did they go up?
Mm-hmm.
And do you see any real difference between the two parties on this issue?
I wish I could say there's a huge difference. Clinton signed in 1994 one of the worst federal laws in terms of ramping up, you know, cracking down mandatory minimums, juvenile transfer laws. Obama certainly was better. I'm not sure if it was because he was a Democrat or if it was because he was in a moment where he could be, right? I mean, he was the first sitting president to visit a prison. He oversaw the clemency initiative that really ushered in the release of first-time nonviolent drug offenders who were serving these huge, long sentences in federal prisons. But I'm not sure that we can say, oh, that's because he was blue and the others were red. I just, I wish it were that simple, but it hasn't been historically. And even Hillary Clinton, when she was on the campaign trail, had to deal with the fact that she had really been a part of that 94 crime bill.
Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with you that it is a reform of the criminal justice system and all those other absolutely necessary forms that we as citizens must be looking at, because I think it's our democracy, it's not, it is at stake, no question. I appreciate the work you've done, but I encourage us all to give consideration about how suddenly the Koch brothers want to get on board. I think we have to look a little bit deeper, because what my brain says is, does this make sense?
Right. I will say this. I mention them just as an example of sort of unlikely allies in this process. I am hugely encouraged by, and this is democracy in action, what's driving this is the electorate. So California is a great example. California has a world-class educational system, or at least it once did, right? I went to law school in California. Their state school system is very impressive. Well, they reached a point where they were spending more on corrections than higher education. Right, that's true in 18 states, but California is a huge state, right? So for them to be spending more on corrections than higher education is a big deal. And when their citizenry realized that, they said, you know what? We're fed up. And so they abolished the nation's most severe three strikes provision. Right? California had the most severe three strikes law on the books that said if you commit, you know, three felonies, that by the third strike you're serving automatic life without parole. The voters overturned that three strikes provision and only narrowly upheld the death penalty by referendum. So I think it is a grassroots thing that's driving this change. And a lot of it is coming from fiscal concerns. Fiscal concerns where the taxpayers are saying, that's not where I want my money going. I want my money going to schools, not prisons.
I want to thank you for your advocacy and everything. I am a formerly incarcerated person who served a 10-year mandatory minimum in federal prison.
Okay.
When people say the system is broken, it seems to me that the system is working exactly the way that it was designed.
Yeah.
If we understand the history of the prison industrial complex. And so I just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because I think maybe it's broken for us, the people, but for the people that are benefiting off incarceration, you know, new slavery. And
so I agree with what you're saying, that there are vested interests that stand to benefit from this industrial complex, and as long as it's in existence, they will stand to benefit. That's why I said I'm not as troubled by the private prisons as I am by the unions and the employees of correctional facilities, only because the private prisons are smaller in number. When I say it's broken, I guess I'm bringing to it the perspective of a lawyer and an advocate. So when I say it's broken, I mean it's broken in the sense that we should not have two systems in this country, and we do, right? So Brian Stevenson is a Supreme Court advocate, argues for kids all the time. He says all the time when he talks that you are better off in this country being guilty and wealthy than poor and innocent, and he's right. And that is scary, and it's wrong, and it's unconstitutional, and it should be an embarrassment to this country. So that's what I mean when I say it's broken, that, you know, we've said since 1963 that if you're a poor person accused of a crime, you have the right to an attorney because the state can't just hail you into court and throw you away without representation. We say that, but 55 years later, that right has never been realized on the ground. That's how it's broken, right? Or the fact that 94% of cases in this country are resolved through a plea bargaining process where the prosecutor basically exacts everything they can from that person. Why? Because they can. Right? That's how it's broken. So I agree with what you said. I'm just coming at it from a constitutional perspective. Like, thanks for your work.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all so much. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
You were just listening to Kara Drynan on the justice system's war on kids. She spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. Kara Drynan is professor of law at Catholic University, and she's the author of The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Michelle Alexander, Brian Stevenson, Jonathan Kozel, Nancy McLean, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Angela Davis. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Ed Mays recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.